Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, an interesting look at corporations and politicians and the war they've declared on democracy. I hope you'll stay tuned. I came across an interesting though obscure movie the other day. Obscure in the sense of little known, not in the sense of murky. The movie is titled Ethos. Now, ethos is one of those oddball words from classical Greek that nobody knows exactly what they mean. Like hubris. Last I heard, nobody knows what hubris means. Not even classical scholars. So you can confidently proclaim that Achilles' downfall was caused by hubris. Or the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan out of hubris, and nobody can prove you wrong. That's the beauty of it. But I come to speak not of hubris, but of ethos. Actually, I studied ancient Greek back in college. Probably out of hubris. The verbs killed me. No man alive, and very few women, could remember all the rules for conjugating a verb in ancient Greek. As I recall, each verb had 179 parts, and each part was conjugated separately. Every letter varied, not only according to tense and mood, but depending on whether the nearest noun was masculine, or feminine, or neuter, or transgendered, or transsexual, or bisexual, or lesbian, or homosexual, or curious, or confused, or just in the mood to try something different. Nobody could ever get a Greek verb exactly right, not even Zeus. You burst into camp, trying to chant, "The Persians are attacking!" You get one accent mark pointing in the wrong direction, and it ends up meaning, could it be that the Persians might have considered attacking us in the past? While everyone is scratching his head, trying to figure out why you're shouting, the Persians burst in and slaughter everybody. That's why there are no more ancient Greeks. The verbs did them in. If hubris and ethos were verbs, even the Greeks couldn't tell you what they meant. Fortunately, they're nouns. To make a long story short, ethos means something like character. And the movie Ethos has some things to say about the character of our time. Most of them uncomplimentary, as you can imagine. The movie Ethos was released in 2011. It has two different narrators. One is the film's writer and director, Pete McGrain. He's the one with the Scottish accent. The second narrator is the actor Woody Harrelson. He's the one with the Texas accent. In our first selection, Ethos talks about politicians and about democracy, and why the two seem to have so little in common. A large part of that reason is corporations, which increasingly control governments rather than vice versa. Here's Ethos the movie.
Politics, politicians, democracy, and the lack thereof.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky.
I think that gay marriage should be allowed. I do not believe that gay marriages should be legal.
I am honored to be here with Barack Obama. So shame on you, Barack Obama.
Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, these countries are tiny compared to the Soviet Union. They don't pose a serious threat to us.
Iran is a great threat.
They contradict each other. They contradict themselves. They will say or do anything to get elected.
We can end illegal immigration.
We're never ever going to be able to totally control immigration.
And every day, it's more lies, more deceit, more corruption.
We have a safe and sound banking system.
I think the system basically is sound.
It's difficult to take these people seriously. And little wonder people have turned away from politics. Only 30% of Americans voted in the 2004 elections. And that was in the middle of a war.
You have said in the past that it was, quote, pretty well confirmed.
No, I never said that.
Okay.
I never said that. That's absolutely not. What I said was, it's been pretty well confirmed.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
The truth is, there's really very little difference between them. That may seem counterintuitive, but when you look at the voting records, foreign policy, and opinions, the idea that they're very different begins to break down quite quickly. They vote the same an average of 84% of the time.
There's a couple of completely logical reasons why our politicians are so similar. The end game for politicians is to get elected. The people who vote are, for the most part, quite moderate in their views. Both parties try to occupy that middle, moderate ground. They are simply responding to that majority in order to get elected. The second reason our politicians are so similar is much more sinister. They answer increasingly to the same master.
Bill Hogan, the Center for Public Integrity.
Thank you so much. We're looking easily at the first $1 billion presidential election, and it's much bigger money than we've ever seen in a presidential election. We define a candidate as being serious or not by how much money they can raise, not by what ideas they have, what their record in public service might have been. It's all about money. We really don't have an election anymore. We have an auction. And what's for sale? I mean, these are interesting questions to ask. Every incoming president rewards big donors with ambassadorships and other honorary appointments like that. There are all kinds of policy issues. Is a big donor rewarded with a place on a federal advisory panel that might have something to do with, say, approving new drugs or environmental regulations? All of these questions about what's for sale. You know, is government for sale? Is the White House for sale? And I think a lot of Americans suspect that it is. Money flows in for a reason, and the reason is not good government.
It is completely unrealistic to expect democracy to deliver representatives who will serve the people's interests when so much money is involved. Having so much money in politics gives all the power to those with money. Yes, we are all still allowed to vote, but how free is our choice? The media, in the hands of big business, will only present us with politicians that will serve their interests. It would be completely illogical for them to do otherwise. It would also be illogical to expect politicians to change a system that puts them in power. But it certainly begs the question, just what kind of democracy do we have?
Noam Chomsky, MIT professor.
Do you want to live in a democratic society, or do you want to live in the society we have? Which, remember, is not a democratic society and is not intended to be. If you take a course in political theory here, I'm sure they'll teach you that the United States is not a democracy. It's what's called in the technical literature a polyarchy. A polyarchy is a system in which power resides in the hands of those whom Madison called the wealth of the nation, the responsible class of men, and the rest of the population is fragmented. That's the way the country was founded.
Tony Benn, British Member of Parliament.
Throughout the history of the world, the rich and powerful have dominated it, and very few people have had any control of their own governments. The most real power in the world is still exercised by those we do not elect. We are still far from governing ourselves. The basis of democracy is the belief that we were all born equal and that that equality must be accepted by those in power. But in the attempts to win those rights, many people have been imprisoned and tortured by those who have power and were determined to retain it.
In the period of the 1980s, there was a major counter-revolution against democracy. President Reagan in America, Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, I think they realized that if there wasn't something done to change it, democracy would succeed. And they said, we're not having that. No one in power really wants democracy, because democracy would challenge their power structures and their authority. So anyone who comes out with a democratic idea is dismissed as unrepresentative or a troublemaker or an extremist or something. And in this way, the full flow of a public debate about alternatives is being extinguished.
Big business is about making money. That's what big business does well. Governments, however, have to balance the needs of the whole society, including big business, based on ethics and social and moral responsibility. But if our corporations have become more powerful than our governments, then we have to understand the effect that is going to have on our systems.
100 years ago, the corporation was relatively insignificant. But today, the corporation has become the most dominant institution in our society.
Howard Zinn, historian and author.
Corporations are artificial creations. You might say they're monsters trying to devour as much profit as possible at anyone's expense. The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War to give equal rights to black people. And what happens is the corporations come into court, and corporation lawyers are very clever, and they say, oh, you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property. We are a person. A corporation is a person. And the Supreme Court goes along with that.
Having acquired the legal rights of a person, the question then arises, just what kind of person is a corporation?
These are a special kind of persons which are designed by law to be concerned only for their stockholders and not, say, what are sometimes called their stakeholders, like the community or the workforce or whatever.
I believe the mistake that a lot of people make when they think about corporations is they think, you know, corporations are like us. They have feelings, they have politics, they have belief systems. They really only have one thing, the bottom line.
All publicly traded corporations have been structured through a series of legal decisions to have a very disturbing characteristic. They are required by law to place the financial interests of their owners above everything else, even the public good.
Noam Chomsky, MIT professor.
That's not a law of nature. That's a very specific decision, in fact, a judicial decision. So they're concerned only for the short-term profit of their stockholders, who are very highly concentrated.
Ray Anderson, CEO of Interface, the world's largest carpet manufacturer.
So the pressure's on the corporation to deliver results now and to externalize any cost that this unwary or uncaring public will allow it to externalize.
Samuel Epstein, professor of environmental medicine.
Something happened in 1940 which marked the beginning of a new era, the era of the ability to synthesize and create on an unlimited scale new chemicals that had never existed before in the world.
And using the magic of research, oil companies compete with each other in taking the petroleum molecule apart and rearranging it into, well, you name it.
So suddenly it became possible to produce any new chemicals, synthetic chemicals, the likes of which had never existed before in the world, for any purpose and at virtually no cost. As the petrochemical era grew and grew, warning signs emerged that some of these chemicals could pose hazards. The data initially were trivial, anecdotal, but gradually a body of data started accumulating to the extent that we now know that the synthetic chemicals which have permeated our workplace produce cancer and also birth defects. We are now in the midst of a major cancer epidemic. I have no doubt, and I have documented the basis for this, that industry is largely responsible for this overwhelming epidemic of cancer, in which one in every two men get cancer in their lifetimes and one in every three women get cancer in their lifetimes. Towards the end of 1989, a great box of documents arrived at my office without any indication where they came from. And I opened them and found in it a complete set of Monsanto files, particularly a set of files dealing with toxicological testing of cows who've been given RBGH.
BST, trade name Posilac, is being used in more than a quarter of the dairy herds in the United States, according to Monsanto. The milk has been drunk by a large portion of the American population since the Food and Drug Administration declared it safe for both cows and humans 4 years ago.
And at that time, Monsanto was saying, there's no evidence whatsoever of any adverse effects, we don't use antibiotics, and this clearly showed that they had lied through their teeth. The files described areas of chronic inflammation in the heart, lung, kidney, spleen, also reproductive effects, also a whole series of other problems.
There's a cost to the cows. The cows get sicker when they're injected with RBGH. They're injected with antibiotics. We know that people are consuming antibiotics through their food, and we know that that's contributing to antibiotic-resistant bacteria and diseases. And we know we're at a crisis when somebody can go into a hospital and get a staph infection and it can't be cured and they die. That's a crisis.
Again and again, we have the problem that whether you obey the law or not is a matter of whether it's cost-effective. If the chance of getting caught and the penalty are less than it costs to comply, people think of it as being just a business decision.
Every living system of Earth is in decline. Every life support system of Earth is in decline. And these together constitute the biosphere. The biosphere that supports and nurtures all of life, and not just our life, but perhaps 30 million other species that share this planet with us. The typical company of the 20th century, extractive, wasteful, abusive, linear in all of its processes, taking from the earth, making, wasting, sending its products back to the biosphere, waste to a landfill. We're leaving a terrible legacy of poison and diminishment of the environment for our grandchildren's grandchildren, generations not yet born.
Sam Gibara, chairman, former CEO of Goodyear, the world's largest tire corporation.
Corporations have gone global. And by going global, the governments have lost some control over corporations, regardless of whether the corporation can be trusted or cannot be trusted. Governments today do not have over the corporations the power that they had and the leverage that they had 50 or 60 years ago. And that's a major change. So governments have become powerless compared to where they were before.
Capitalism today commands the towering heights and has displaced politics and politicians as the new high priests.
Corporations, by law, must increase their bottom line. In order to expand, they have to sell more products. Sell more products, they must consume more resources. Even going back 50 years, we could see the effect that this was having on our environment. Today, the effects of pollution and industrialization have multiplied tenfold, and the damage is terrifying. And yet these same corporations still want to drill for oil in the Arctic. And that's not just morally blind, that's morally bankrupt. Also, corporate expansion into other countries to get those resources is the cause of so much war and conflict, as you will see in this film. We need our corporations to bring us the technologies, many of which already exist, that can help us address the issues we face. And yet, the system encourages a thirst for short-term profit.
We are listening to selections from the 2011 documentary Ethos. We heard the part about corporations and politicians together declaring war on democracy. For now, let's skip over a section on the international banking cartel and pick up on the media and how the powers that be use the media and politics to control public opinion and thus subvert democracy. Here again is Ethos, the movie.
The media.
We get almost all of our information from the media. If we base our opinions on bad or biased information, then everything we believe is suspect. Political debate today is kept within very narrow boundaries, so the media can present both sides of these narrow positions and give the impression we have a free press. However, To talk about left or right wing press is to miss a very important point. Whatever message big business wants carried, with whatever slant, the media will carry that story unfailingly.
Manufacturing consent. What is that title meant to describe?
Well, the title is actually borrowed from a book by Walter Lippmann, written back around 1921, in which he described what he called the manufacture of consent as a revolution in the practice of democracy. What it amounts to is a technique of control. And he said this was useful and necessary because the common interests, the general concerns of all people, elude the public. The public just isn't up to dealing with them. And they have to be the domain of what he called a specialized class. Notice that that's the opposite of the standard view about democracy. There's a version of this expressed by the highly respected moralist and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who was very influential on contemporary policymakers. His view was that rationality belongs to the cool observer, but because of the stupidity of the average man, he follows not reason but faith. And this naive faith requires necessary illusion. The point is that in a military state or a feudal state or what we would nowadays call a totalitarian state, it doesn't much matter what people think because you've got a bludgeon over their head and you can control what they do. But when the state loses the bludgeon, when you can't control people by force, and when the voice of the people can be heard, you have this problem. It may make people so curious and so arrogant that they don't have the humility to submit to a civil rule, and therefore you have to control what people think. And the standard way to do this is to resort to what in more honest days used to be called propaganda, manufacture of consent, creation of necessary illusions, various ways of either marginalizing the general public or reducing them to apathy.
Now, I'd say I'm just Jane, USA, and I say, well, gee, this is a democratic society, and what do you mean thought control? I make up my own mind. I create my own destiny. What would you say to her?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would suggest that Jane take a close look at the way the media operate, the way the public relations industry operates, the extensive thinking that's been going on for a long, long period about the necessity for finding ways to marginalize and control the public in democratic societies.
100 years ago, Sigmund Freud, famous for giving us the science of psychological analysis, suggested that the ideal of individual freedom, central to the idea of democracy, was impossible. He said our hidden desires were too dangerous. Human beings could never be allowed to fully express themselves, that we must always be controlled and would thus always be discontent. Sigmund Freud's American nephew was Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today, but his influence on our society is possibly much greater than Freud. Bernays took the new science developed by his famous uncle and used it to manipulate the masses. Bernays is the man who invented the profession and the term public relations. He worked for most of the major corporations and advised politicians on how to win favor with the public. Like Freud, Bernays was convinced that humans were driven by irrational forces, but by stimulating our inner desires and then sating them with consumer products, he created a new way to manage the irrational behavior of the masses.
Democracy, to my father, was a wonderful concept, but I don't think he felt that all those publics out there would had reliable judgment, and that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above. You appeal to their desires and their unrecognized longings, that sort of thing. That you can tap into their deepest desires or their deepest fears and use that to your own purposes.
Many influential thinkers came to believe that the public were incapable of making rational decisions, and that as such, democracy could never work. Walter Lippmann, one of the most influential political writers at that time, argued that if people were in reality motivated by irrational forces, then what was needed was control by the elites to manage what he called the bewildered herd. And this could be accomplished by using psychological techniques to control the unconscious desires of the masses.
Stuart Ewan, historian of public relations.
So here you have Walter Lippmann, probably the most influential political thinker in the United States, who is essentially saying that it's not that the people are in charge, but that the people's desires are in charge. So democracy is reduced from something which assumes an active citizenry to the idea of the public as passive consumers. Driven primarily by instinctual or unconscious desires, and that if you can in fact trigger those needs and desires, you can get what you want from them.
The corporations understood that to change our consumer culture from needs-based to desire-based purchasing, people must be trained to want new things even before the old had been consumed. The corporations understood that they could pacify the masses with consumer goods while increasing profits through mass consumption. Man's desires must overshadow his needs. Edward Bernays was at the very center of shaping this new mentality.
Bernays really is the guy within the United States, more than anybody else, who sort of brings to the table psychological theory as something that is an essential part of how, from the corporate side, of how we are going to appeal to the masses effectively. And the whole sort of merchandising establishment and sales establishment is ready for Sigmund Freud. I mean, they are ready for understanding what motivates the human mind.
He showed the corporations how they could make people want things they did not need by linking products to their unconscious desires. And the mass media would be the key. Most of our ideas about right and wrong, social and moral justice, what is in fashion and what is not, are given to us by the media. And if an idea is given to us by the media, we seldom question it.
The media and marketing men spend billions of dollars in research. They have developed an entire science based on the very best psychology and knows exactly which one of our buttons to press to make us swallow an idea or buy a product. And they're not just selling us laundry detergent. They sell us everything from plastic gadgets to warfare. If we are to make decisions about the future of our society, the single most important thing we need is the truth.
And there we'll end this week's selection from the documentary Ethos, and we'll hear some more next week. The movie was adapted to radio by my esteemed colleague Robin Upton. From his own spacious underground studio in sunny Dhaka, Bangladesh, of all places, Robin produces the weekly radio show and podcast Unwelcome Guests. Take a listen for yourself at www.unwelcomeguests.net. You'll find a link to that at our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From the dark heart of darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening and advising illegitimi non carborundum, drink plenty of liquids, and ciao.